James, the new novel by Percival Everett, retells, reframes, and reimagines Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn from the perspective of Jim, the black man whose flight from slavery quickly entangles with the journey of Huck, on the run after faking his own death to escape his violent father. James gives us the events of Twain's picaresque from a vital new standpoint, opening up previously unexplored planes of character consciousness as it does so, expanding and subverting the original story. And the novel doesn't just fill in the blanks about Jim's movement when our protagonists are separated, but also rests the narrative arc itself in new and astonishing directions. It's difficult to think of a writer of this or any age more suited to revisiting this contentious monument of American letters than Percival Everett. Over 24 novels, he has demonstrated himself to be a deeply moral yet utterly undogmatic writer. A writer who is irrepressibly mischievous with language, but also cognizant of its immense power. A writer who skewers injustice by meticulously demonstrating its absurdity. A writer of enormous erudition, worn with exquisite lightness. A writer who takes few things more seriously than humour. Or to put it another way, a writer who has enough in common with Mark Twain to pull off such a feat, but enough that separates him to offer something wholly fresh. As a result, James works both as a companion, often a corrective to Twain's book, and also as a work of art that stands defiantly alone. Percival Everett, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Well, thank you, Adam, and yes, that was quite an introduction.
Well, it's quite an introduction for quite a book. Could we begin by talking about the significance of Mark Twain, and more specifically Huckleberry Finn? I guess first to American letters as you see it, but also specifically to you as a writer, because as I kind of alluded to in the introduction, at least to me, and maybe you would disagree with this, but I get a sense that in certain ways, you could be seen as writing in a similar tradition to Mark Twain.
Oh, I think to address that first, I think that's probably true. The use of vernacular and my concern of visiting the American experience, honestly, I think is in keeping with Twain's mission. You know, it's a iconic text on our literary landscape. Mm-hmm. The attention to it paid by other writers certainly makes it so. And you know, that probably flippant remark of Hemingway's, but still somewhat true. It's the first time that you have a novel that's not about slavery, but about an enslaved person. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't Twain's mission or desire to write a novel about Jim. His main character is Huck. So I don't see myself as offering a corrective to the novel. I'm doing something different, doing something mm-hmm. that Twain wasn't equipped to do, but also was decidedly doing something. He was decidedly doing something else. Mm-hmm. The fascinating part about it is that Huck, this American youth, is a young America. This nation is only 100 years old at the time, not that old. Well, just about that old when the novel comes out, just a bit older than 100. But it's set in a time of Twain's youth when it was not 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And you have this youth, America, wandering through its own landscape, dealing with that one thing that becomes the most defining feature of the American landscape, which is race. Mm-hmm. And dealing with it, quite honestly, trying to reconcile the fact that this person who is his friend is also property. So in that way, it is truly significant. And again, it's a really honest attempt to understand this American experience. So in that way, I'm trying to at least own up to or live up to Twain's mission. Mm-hmm.
I used the word contentious in the introduction, and I get the sense in the last couple of decades, this book has become quite difficult, at least from a point of view of teachers of American literature, to handle in the classroom. And not perhaps so much because of the moral of the book, if we can speak so flippantly, but because of its vernacular use proving quite shocking, I guess, to modern ears.
Sad, yes. You know, the presence of the unfortunate word, we'll call it, is and I have actually no problem using it in context. The word is nigger that gives so many people problems. Just like any other word, it's context that affects its meaning and its offensiveness. The use of the word in the novel is necessary to understand just who is present and what and who we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. To leave it out would be, in Twain's words, a liable mission. Mm-hmm. You can't make the ugly pretty. We have an ugly history. We have to own up to it. We have to face it. And this, and sadly, this word is a huge part of that history. I venture to say that most people who would like to ban the Adventures of Huckleberry Finn have not actually read it. Mm-hmm. As is often the case with people who want to ban books, it's very likely they haven't read any books. So that's there. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it occurred to me when thinking of the sort of the project, I guess, of telling the story from Jim's perspective, is that actually a few years ago, the book, in a sense, was rewritten in as much as the unfortunate word was removed and replaced by, I think, slave at times and maybe Jim at other times, things like that. Could we talk a little bit about how the project kind of crystallized for you? Because it seems that like this is a book which you've lived with for you know, most of your life, or since when you read it. And is there something specific about now, in whether in your career or in the kind of broader social context, that it felt like the moment for you to write it?
Well, I wish I had, you know, a really profound answer to that. Mm-hmm. And it's not at all. I was probably playing tennis and hit a ball wildly out of the court. Mm-hmm. And then I stood there, and my first thought was, has anyone ever told this story from the point of view of Jim? which was interesting, but also explained my wild shot. And so I checked, and I couldn't find that anyone had. And I thought, why hasn't anyone done this? And then I realized I hadn't thought of it either. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I have walked around thinking of Huck Finn all the time, or even every few years. As, mm-hmm. as much as I do like the novel, it's not a novel I return to yearly, like The Way of All Flesh or something that I really love. Regardless of how important I find it. And so it was simply that thought, mm-hmm. at that moment. And I decided to try to make this.
You put me in mind of, and I've mentioned this before in this podcast, but the Robertson Davies, the Canadian novelist, when he was asked how he got his ideas, he said, "I don't get my ideas get me." And kind of leaves it at that.
I wish that would happen more often.
So if you hadn't sort of been thinking about it that much or hadn't read it that much in recent years, did you then, when you had the idea and when you returned to, I mean, I'm assuming you then picked up the book and reread it to see if you could get a sense of making it work. Had the book changed in your mind since you had last read it? Did it sort of surprise you over again?
No, not really. I think my, you know, it is what it is. It's, mm-hmm. it portends to be an adventure novel, and mm-hmm. the most part it is. And it's an uneven novel in that Twain stopped and came back to it. Mm-hmm. And reinserts Tom Sawyer, probably for mercenary reasons. Uh-huh. Tom Sawyer was his money making book, and Twain was famously in need of money. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really affect the depth of the bulk of the, mm-hmm. of the novel, but it does affect the evenness of it. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But just recently, I've come to think that the horrors of Reconstruction might have informed the latter half of the novel. Mm-hmm. So it's still uneven, but I have more appreciation of it. I think that Twain was perhaps thinking that the treatment of newly freed black people, was very much like being caught in the kind of adventure that Tom Sawyer was imagining, mm-hmm. for Jim. Jim becomes a pawn in this America's game. Mm-hmm. So I'm still thinking that through.
So when you then set about writing James, What was your attitude towards, I guess, fidelity towards the book? So as I said in the introduction, there are moments where definitely the plot of James and the plot of Huck, at least as I remember it, because it has been a while since I read it, too, sort of diverge. But more broadly speaking, did you feel as fidelity to, I guess, the universe that Twain had created?
Well, that's exactly right. I wanted to inhabit that world, but I did not want to inhabit that text. Mm-hmm. And sort of achieve that freedom from the text, I read the novel some 15 times in a row. Mm-hmm. I would come to the end and I would start over immediately.
Right.
So that I got sick of it. Uh-huh. It also became a blur. And then I still haven't looked back at Huck Finn. And it was just a blur of information about a particular world. Mm-hmm. And that worked for me. And my memory of some of those scenes is pretty faithful. But it freed me to create James' world.
Because there's one thing it did make me think of as well was, I'm sure you know it, that story by Borges, the Pierre Ménard, the author of the Quixote. Mm-hmm. And so for listeners who don't know, so this is somebody who has essentially set himself the project of rewriting Don Quixote, but not like a new version, but having word for word the exact same text. And Borges goes into this whole rather wonderful exposition about how, because these particular words are being written by Ménard at this particular time, they have a fundamentally different sense and a deeper sense to when they're being written by Cervantes. And I was put in mind of that because I thought there are moments where I'm guessing the sort of the dialogue and the events tack pretty closely, if not map exactly onto what happens in Huck Finn. And I'm curious to you as a writer, did you feel, in a sense, when you were going over that same ground, that there was necessarily this kind of new infusion of meaning into these moments because you weren't Mark Twain writing in the 19th century, but Percival Everett writing in the 21st century?
Well, certainly that. I don't think the way they talk is actually greatly different from Twain's. But the merely having it from James' point of view changes the perception or our vantage point significantly so that the same scenes are really different. Mm-hmm. And I that gave me some confidence.
Because I guess it's a cliche to say about historical fiction, I think particularly that sort of, oh, it says as much about our time as it does about the time it's portraying.
Well, when you think that America is actually stuck in time, this is actually
well, right. So I was curious about this because obviously, I guess that again, there's this sense of fidelity. So you're inhabiting this universe, but you're also bringing with it this sort of 200 years of kind of continued, I guess, in many ways, sort of stagnation over questions of race in the U.S.
Yeah, well, the defining feature of this landscape remains the same. Mm-hmm. So. There's that.
Considering the lives of Jim and the other people who are held as slaves in this book, that was one thing that really struck me. And again, I guess concerning the tone of the piece and the universe of the piece, because like it's true that Huck isn't quaint in the way the sort of Tom Sawyer might be. There's a certain sort of gentility to Tom Sawyer, but still, you know, I think we certainly in Huck Finn get a lot of the rough edges, particularly about the sort of the life of the slave rubbed off a little bit.
Yes.
Was again, I guess, concerning the subject of fidelity, was there a tension for you as a writer between fidelity to Twain and his universe and fidelity to the brutality and the horror of the lives that people like Jim would have lived?
Again, there was no tension there because I understood, even before I caused that novel to be a mere blur to me, that that wasn't Twain's mission, nor did it fall within the range of his capacity. He was not prepared or equipped to write James' story, and he didn't want to, which is completely fair. But I did,
and so that sort of opened up, I guess, different terrains and even to maybe different tones for you as a writer?
Well, it makes it a different work of art, which is the only way I could have gone about it. Mm-hmm. I never viewed this as a retelling. Mm-hmm. It was more a visiting another world.
Mm-hmm. One of the significant parts of the novel is the way that the enslaved people in the book use language. And it is one of, in one sense, one of the most kind of sort of playful and inventive aspects of the book. But perhaps would you be able to just explain for our listeners a little bit sort of how they speak to each other, and then how that sort of manifests in front of the white people?
It might seem inventive, but I think it's actually very true to human nature and human performance in the world, that oppressed, enslaved, or imprisoned peoples probably always find ways to speak to each other in the presence of their oppressors or mm-hmm. enslavers that doesn't allow entry of those people to their meaning. Mm-hmm. So in James, in the novel, the slaves speak in front of white people using a dialect that's expected of them. Mm-hmm. But when they're alone with each other, for the sake of illustration, they speak in standard English. Mm-hmm. In fact, in an English that lacks the dialect of the that one finds in Huck Finn among white people. Mm-hmm. And to the point where James offers instruction to children at one point on how to speak mm-hmm. slave. In other words, how to satisfy white people who are around them so that they can be safe in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that particularly that idea of safety seems to be paramount in the use of language in this way.
Yeah, certainly. My name is James. I wish I could tell my story with a sense of history as much as industry. I was sold when I was born and then sold again. My mother's mother was from some place on the continent of Africa. I had been told, or perhaps simply assumed. I cannot claim to any knowledge of that world or those people, whether my people were kings or beggars. I admire those who at 5 years of age, like Venture Smith, can remember the clans of their ancestors, their names and their movements, the movements of their families through the wrinkles, trenches, and chasms of the slave trade. I can tell you that I am a man who is cognizant of his world, a man who has a family, who loves a family, who has been torn from his family, a man who can read and write, a man who will not let his story be self-related but self-written. With my pencil, I wrote myself into being. I wrote myself to here.
One of the other ways that language is, I guess, really important when we think of the way that Mark Twain tells the story, Jim's first act of rebellion, in a way, is when he runs off, when he discovers he is about to be sold. But in fact, in your novel, James's rebellion, in many ways, has begun in advance, through his learning of reading and writing. Maybe it's unsurprising that to a writer, there's the power of books and the significance of ideas should feature prominently in this book. But could you just talk a little bit about why that's for James particularly the capacity to read and then his desire to write was important?
Well, I think it's clear to me, at least, that the act of reading is the most subversive thing we can do mm-hmm. in any culture. We do it alone. No one sees what comes into us. We come to it with what we already own in our experience. There's a reason that we talked about book banning. There's a reason that fascist regimes ban books immediately or burn them or some otherwise way. And punish people for visiting them. So for James, like all of us, reading is his avenue to the thing that's most frightening mm-hmm. to his oppressors, which is self-realization, self-knowledge. for lack of a better term, betterment of himself.
And then it's interesting, then we get a little bit of a glimpse into the things that James either chooses to read or that he sort of ends up reading, because these are the books that that come into his hands at various moments. And there seems to be quite a sort of a focus, I guess, in a way, on French sort of Enlightenment thinkers, in a way. So we have references to Rousseau. There's quite a bit about Voltaire as well. We have John Locke as well, of course, who wasn't French. And I'm curious about the sort of your desire as a novelist as well to, I guess, to expand out of the novelistic world of Twain and into the philosophies of these writers too.
Well, the Enlightenment offers wonderful contradictions. Probably I'm evoking Jefferson more than anyone in here, but I didn't want to bring him into it.
Right.
Since he was actually a product of these philosophers. Mm-hmm. But how can someone who pretends to be a thinker write that all humans are equal and then justify slavery, mm-hmm. As all did, or Voltaire in the case of talking about equality, but then suggesting that equality is more achieved than actually extant. Mm-hmm. and that's what I'm taking to task.
Why did you not want to evoke Jefferson directly?
Again, he's not a philosopher and is a product of those philosophers. But also I think it just muddies the waters of the novel. Mm-hmm. Maybe making it too American. Also, there simply wouldn't be any works of his in that library.
And then, of course, there's also the thing. So James reads the philosophy, but they also, in the case of Voltaire, he reads Candide as well.
Yes.
And there is a, it's not a particularly kind of extended reflection, but there is a kind of an evocation of the sort of the, I guess, the power of fiction and what fiction can do and what sort of, I guess, storytelling and narrative can do, compared to perhaps a work of, I don't want to say dry philosophy, but straight up sort of philosophical essays or something like that. Does that feed into then James's desire to write, in fact, that there's some sort of magic perhaps, or sense of self-creation to constructing a narrative, to telling a story?
I think it's more the mechanics of it. I don't think there's anything magic about it. It's that this is what stories do. It's the business of making sense of the world. And given the opportunity, one should make these. Mm-hmm. In fact, one is required to make them. We understand the world through stories, mm-hmm. and whether they are fictive or historical. In fact, often truth resides more in fiction than it does in history. Our understanding that factual and truthful don't always equate.
Mm-hmm. Could I just pick up on those words, because I'm interested to just unpack them a little bit. You said what should and one is required to. Is that should as a sort of a moral imperative and required to as a kind of necessity in a way?
I think required to is logically necessary to understand one's place. But I always hesitate to talk about moral imperatives. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it's a matter of survival, mm-hmm. that one attempt to construct those stories. Uh-huh. Otherwise, someone will do it for you.
I suppose it was a slightly kind of loaded question when I mentioned the moral imperative, because one of the things that kept coming to me when I was reading James was this question about how somebody, to simplify, who seems like a broadly sort of good person, navigates this idea of morality in a sort of fundamentally immoral world. So there are moments, you know, I guess quite minor moral breaches where James has to steal something to eat, for example. But there are also questions of then committing what might be called murder. And I found that really a really fascinating reflection in the book. And it seemed to be one of the things that's, in a sense, one of the tensions that lies at the heart of James's story.
I think that's probably true. It's certainly the case that the people in the world who are treated the worst know how people should not be treated.
And then I guess as a kind of corollary to that, we have this idea of religion as well, which there was something quite bracing about the fact of sort of how readily James and the other enslaved people reject religion as a tool of oppression.
Yes, would that were actually the case. but it's, you know, it's I think it would be quite natural to think that if they're giving this to us, there must be something wrong. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to connect this directly to religion, although maybe it's inevitable. Another thing that's at the heart of Twain's book and also at the heart of your book is this idea of the confidence man and the confidence trick as well. So in Twain's book and in James, we have the Duke and the King. So these two kind of deeply kind of comic burlesque characters. And one thing, and again, like this sort of without wanting to, it's difficult sometimes as a reader, sort of particularly now I know when I'm going to be speaking to the writer, not to try and project thoughts and reflections into your mind. But one thing that kept coming back to me when reading about the Duke and the King, and also at a certain moment in the book, James and another character at least plan their own series of confidence tricks. And the thought that just kept coming back to me was sort of almost like this idea of slavery, and perhaps further the idea of race as like almost like the biggest confidence trick that history has ever pulled.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. It's a construction that without any basis that has become a hugely real thing that doesn't exist. And as all confidence games work, they work because someone wants something. Mm-hmm. If there is no desire there to have a thing, then you can't cheat them.
Yeah.
And the culture apparently needed this. Mm-hmm. And that need generates its own need. The confidence man, it's as human as anything one can imagine. Mm-hmm. It's taking advantage of expectations, what people want. Mm-hmm. I mean, my God, look at Donald Trump.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'd rather not. But you
know, a hobo millionaire.
We haven't got a great deal of time left, but one thing that I would like to talk about, I guess, is the friendship of Huck and Jim. There is in Twain's book, there is definitely a complicity. Like it's definitely a fraught complicity, but like there's something in their two experiences, which I don't know, permits a comprehension, permits some sort of coming together or some sort of overlap for them.
It's certainly the case that in Twain's book, the only real positive male role model for Huck is Jim. Mm-hmm. Sort of off screen, off page, Judge Thatcher notwithstanding.
Right.
But Huck, Jim is the only father figure. Mm-hmm. Again, he's not fleshed out in Twain's novel. And it's also the case that as they move through this, what Jim needs from Huck is a weird kind of protection in the world. Mm-hmm. He can't be alone because then he's an escapee. Huck is his beard. Mm-hmm. And he is throughout the story protecting this boy from the world. Mm-hmm. So there's I don't know whether it's complicity, but there's a mutual need.
Yeah. Which did also make me think of returning to The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but because that is written in the voice of Huck, it's essentially Huck's telling of the story. And because your book and Twain's book diverge at certain moments very significantly on aspects of plot, it did make me think, actually, one of the things you've done with James is to send people back to sort of question, in a way, Huck's veracity as a narrator. And in a way that these books, I think, could be read almost as kind of as companion pieces, in a way that, like, you can go back to Huck's telling of the story and, having read James, perhaps understand it differently and see that perhaps, you know, there are certain elements of his telling in which he is perhaps, you know, protecting James or telling his story in certain ways that that will you know, blow smoke in the eyes of anybody who might read it.
Oh, I had loved that. And of course that was in my mind. I flatter myself by thinking I'm not correcting or rewriting Huck Finn, but I'm in conversation with Twain. Mm-hmm. And doing that, again, for me, underscores the power of fiction, in that anyone would return to these fictive worlds for some understanding of truth and what mm-hmm. really happened, in talking about things that never happened. Mm-hmm. that's the beauty of fiction. You can make readers argue about whether the actions of a character are true to that character. They're arguing about someone who does not exist. Mm-hmm. That's wonderfully sick.
Yeah. considering, like, how the book, I guess, might be received and how it might sort of become part of the conversation. I was talking, I won't name this person because I haven't asked them, but a friend of mine, a Black British writer, who said that sort of had read the book and said they thought it was extraordinary. But in addition, they said that they thought it would be a way to allow particularly literature teachers in America to be able to teach Huck again, to bring it into both books into the classroom as a way to give kind of greater contextualization, perhaps greater balance. Do you, as a novelist, think of how your book may contribute to a wider social conversation, how it could become alongside of being a work of art as a kind of pedagogical tool? Or is that sort of something which you have to keep out of your mind?
You see, you use the word think and novelist in the same sentence and you already have a problem. No, I just made this after it's done. That's a wonderful thing to think might happen, but it was never in my mind. I don't put it in my mind now. Who knows how works of art will get used. The only reason I think I write, and I think most artists make their art, is because they think they can affect the world in which they live mm-hmm. in some way. How we affect it, I don't think we can ever know. And my model for this is Picasso's Guernica. Mm-hmm. You know, it changed the world. And you have to remember that not very many people saw it.
Right.
That's kind of remarkable. And so there's always that remote possibility that you can affect a couple of the thinking of a couple of people.
Mm-hmm. But one never banks on it.
Well, I mean, the fact that I'm writing fiction to make a living is already ample evidence that I'm morally deficient, you know, intellectually deficient anyway.
Which I think is the perfect point on which to leave it. James, of course, is available from Shakespeare and Company, from our bricks and mortar store, from our website as well, or from your local independent bookstore, wherever that may be. Percival Everett, this has been such a pleasure today. Thank you so much for joining us.
The pleasure's been mine. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favorite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare and Company Paris. All music is by Alex Fryman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.